Thank you, John. Are we on here? All right. It's always good to be here. Always brings back, so many memories being here, but I'm obviously here every Sunday. But just have such an appreciation and love for this church, for our pastoral team. So when the team is out or away or traveling and I get the occasional call to come and speak, it's always a privilege. So excited to be with you this morning and to dive into the Word of God into part two of the summer series that we have, which is a summer of unforgettable Bible stories. And sometimes when you're asked to speak, you don't know what the series is going to be, or maybe it's a series and you just kind of have to fit in. This is one that I was so excited that Pastor Caleb asked me to share because I love these unforgettable Bible stories that we have. And as I was thinking about it, these awe-inspiring, these stories that we'll never forget, we'll always remember. I think sometimes in church and sometimes in Christianity, we downplay them a little bit. We relegate them to, oh, that's just a nice story, or that's a cute story, or I heard that growing up in Sunday school, or, that's kind of Bible 101. And we downplay it a little bit, and sometimes we overlook some of the best scriptures, the best passages in the entire Bible. Maybe we think, oh, I learned that in kids' church, so you can't really preach from that on a Sunday morning because that's kind of a kids' church message. This is grown-up church. We need to be more spiritual and more mature here, right? Or we think everybody's heard that before. What else can be said about these passages that people haven't heard before? We need to bring something new. It's this view that those Bible stories, that's Bible 101. This isn't a Bible 101 church. This is a Bible 201 church. We preach out of Ecclesiastes and Philemon and these lesser known books. And then the really spiritual churches, the Bible 301, they're doing 10-week series out of Leviticus and nobody knows what in the world's going on. But we do all of this stuff and I kind of poke fun at it. But in a certain way, we think that these classic stories are too basic. But there's a reason why these are the best stories in the Bible. There's a reason why we teach them to our kids in Sunday school. And it's not something we should pass over. When I was in Bible college, I had a homiletics professor. And homiletics is the art of preaching or writing a sermon, preparing a sermon. And it was Dr. Searle, who's a part of our church congregation. And I remember him saying something to our class that I'll never forget. And he said simply this, "Preach the good stuff." Here we are in Bible college, you're studying all these obscure passages and trying to, come up with something maybe nobody ever heard before. It's dangerous when you try to preach a message that nobody's ever heard before. That's why you get yourself into trouble. Preach the good stuff. So that's what this series is all about. And last week, Pastor Caleb opened the message with the story of Jacob wrestling the angel. And as we look through Scripture, we have other classic Bible stories like Noah's Ark. We have Jonah and the whale, or the fish, or the whale, or whatever side of the fence you're on in that argument. We have Daniel and the lion's den. We have Moses delivering the people out of Israel. But all of those stories pale in comparison to the story of all stories, the most epic saga of all time that's been talked about for centuries. It's been turned into movies. It's been alluded to in speeches. It's even been painted by Michelangelo, the story that we are going to talk about today. Are you ready for it? Ready for this? It is the story of David and his lifetime tax exemption. You're laughing. You don't know this story? I see some blank faces too. You don't know the story of David and his lifetime tax exemption? I mean, this is an incredible, epic Bible story. You probably know it as the story of David and Goliath. Oh, that one. But in it, they say there's only two things in this life that are certain, death and taxes. Well, David faced death against the giant and actually got out of having to pay taxes for him and his family for the rest of his life. That's a miracle. Come on, nobody gets out of paying taxes. What's the real miracle here, getting out of taxes or defeating the giant? All right, that's not what I'm talking about today. We're looking at the story of David and Goliath, though. And in the story of David and Goliath, it really is a battle of perspective. A battle of perspective. And there's so many other players involved. David and Goliath take center stage. But there's six different players really involved in this story in six different perspectives. It really could be the story of David and Goliath and the Israelites and Jesse his father and Eliab his older brother and Saul the king. There's six perspectives that we see at play. But we focus on David and Goliath. And this story really is, it's the ultimate royal rumble. The Philistines' best man versus the Israelites' best man. Mano y mano. This would be the pay-per-view fight of the century. Forget Rumble in the Jungle or Thrilla in Manila. I don't know what they would coin it. I'll coin it the Melee in the Valley, because they actually fought in a valley. And more than just the hand-to-hand combat, the few verses that we have about the actual battle that took place, what I like about this, and like any good fight, is all the buildup, all of the promotion that went into this thing, all of the hype. We know the story. David went out, hit him with a stone. It was a quick KO. It only took a couple verses to describe that, but there's 40 verses of buildup before this battle takes place. There's trash talk, there's interviews, there's perspectives, there's opinions, there's all of this hype around it. You know, the story of David and Goliath, it's used a lot in metaphors too. You see it a lot in sports. You know, anytime an underdog team is going up against a stronger team, the commentators will say, yeah, it's a real, you know, real underdog battle, real David versus Goliath moment. You know, the commentators have it all wrong, because David was not the underdog here. Not at all. Goliath was the huge, huge underdog. He was going against God. He was going against God was undefeated. He's never lost. And here Goliath is thinking that, you know, he's kind of a big deal and thinking much of himself. He was the complete underdog in the situation. We'll get into that later. Goliath actually called himself a dog in the middle of the fight. So I think he even kind of knew it. But there was all this buildup around this story. And in this story, we learn more about who David was. We learn that Goliath wasn't the only thing he was battling that day. See, everybody in this story had their own perspective, their own way of seeing the situation, their own way of seeing David, their own way of seeing Goliath. And we're going to look at all of these different perspectives through this story of David and Goliath. So first, let's talk about perspective a little bit. What is perspective? Perspective is a particular attitude toward or way of regarding something, or simply put, it's a point of view. You could be looking at the same thing, but somebody views it from this point of view, and another person views it from this point of view. They have a slightly different perspective. Perspective is how we see things, how we interpret situations. Is the glass half empty, or is the glass half full? Now, this isn't just some message about, hey, let's be more optimistic and more positive thinking, and let's do a little kumbaya and hold hands and be on our day, right? It's good to be more positive in our thinking. We need more positive thinkers in this world. We need more positive speaking in this world. We need to speak life more often. But sometimes we find ourselves in situations and we can't just work up a positive thought to get ourselves out of it. Sometimes we need something a little bit more than just positivity. And I don't want to diminish that at all. If you get anything out of this message, just start thinking more positive. That will change 95% of the things that you face in this life. But there's some things where we need a little extra. We need to rely on God much more. Perspective. An example of viewing two different perspectives. Maybe you've heard the tale of the two traveling shoe salesmen. And they went to a third world country to scope it out as a potential market. And when they both get there, they assess the situation, and the first shoe salesman immediately calls back home to his wife and says, "Honey, I'm coming home. There's no market here. Everybody's running around, and nobody wears shoes. I can't. There's nothing I can do here. Nobody even knows what a shoe is here. I'm coming home." The second guy looks at the situation, immediately gets on the phone, calls his wife, says, "Honey, I'm going to be here a while. There is a huge market. There's not a single person here wearing shoes. I can sell to every single person in this country." The exact same situation, but two totally different perspectives of how it was viewed. In the story of David and Goliath, there are several different perspectives that we look at. And in all of the perspectives, there's always God's perspective that shows up on the scene. talking about a glass being half empty or half full. And, we're sitting over here and arguing, and are you an optimistic person or a pessimistic person? And we have all this theology and debate and philosophy, and here's Jesus over here giving water to those who are thirsty. And we're over here trying to figure out if the glass is half empty or half full. See, when God shows up with his perspective, you forget what you were even arguing about, because it's not about that. It's about, it completely changes our mindset and our perspective. And that's why we need his mindset. So we're going to look at six perspectives through the story of David and Goliath. And the first one is the principled perspective. And we see this through the Israelites. The principled perspective is that can turn into a system of beliefs. That's exactly what a principle is. It's a foundational truth that serves as a foundation for a system of beliefs. And we have good principles, biblical principles, godly principles, and we have bad principles that gradually get formed over time from circumstances and facts and details that happen. So what is the difference between just a simple fact and an actual principle? Well, in the story of David and Goliath, Goliath was a real-life giant. That is a fact. The Israelites were not giants. That also is a fact. Goliath was a warrior. The Israelites were warriors, but not in the likes of Goliath. Those are all just some background facts of the story. And as we jump into it in 1 Samuel 17, verse 4, we start hearing all of these facts about Goliath. It says, "And there went out a champion out of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. A cubit is about the length of your forearm, about a foot and a half. And so you do the quick math. He was 6 cubits times a foot and a half. That means he was over 9 feet tall. He really was a giant. That was a fact. We get a couple more stats. We get his bio, in this corner, and we're reading all about Goliath. He had a helmet of brass upon his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of brass, about 125 pounds. You go on to verse 6, and he had greaves of brass upon his legs and a target of brass between his shoulders. In verse 7, it says, "And the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam. The spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, about 15 pounds alone, just on the end of his spear. And one bearing a shield went before him." So we got his bio. We have all of this information about Goliath. It's a lot of detail, and it was all true. It was factual. But here's where I want you to listen to me. If we are not careful, the facts that are given so that God might be glorified could end up being misused and produce a principle of fear and unbelief in our own life. Why was all of this recorded about Goliath? So that God would be glorified. But instead, it produced a different result in the Israelites. They saw all these facts and all of these details, and they were fixated on them. And over time, these small details became principles of, we cannot defeat that guy. That's more than a fact. There's a principle that they've already felt defeated. And Goliath would come out and for 40 days ridicule the Israelites. And they listened to it happen. They watched it happen. They saw him, and they were fixated on how big he was, how strong he was, how much his armor weighed, how much his helmet weighed, and how big his biceps were, and what was his blood type. They knew everything about him. And it produced a principle of fear and unbelief. This went on for 40 days. After 40 days, the details about Goliath turned into principles in the minds of the Israelites. And as he went out and spoke this, as we continue in the story in verse 11, it says, "When Saul and Israel heard those words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid." When we face giants in our life, facts are okay as long as they don't form a principle where we are admitting defeat before we even go to the battle. If you listen to anything for 40 days, it's going to affect your mindset and your perspective. But they allowed this to continue on. This principled perspective that we can adopt so easily. What does it look like? Well, it says things like, I'm just calling it like I see it. You ever said that? I'm just calling it like I see it. It is what it is. How do you argue with that? And what kind of argument is that anyways? It is what it is. If it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it's got to be a duck, right? And we turn these principles into perspectives that forever shape our worldview. Let me give you another example. Maybe in your own life, something difficult happens to you. Maybe you were genuinely hurt by another individual. That's a fact. You were hurt. Maybe the person even admits that they hurt you. And it's decided that is a fact. But we can allow that fact to produce forgiveness and say, even though this happened, I'm going to forgive you anyways. Or we can allow it to create a principle where we say, you know what? I just can't forgive that person on a matter of principle. Just can't do it, won't do it, not going to happen. That is a dangerous perspective to have. And I feel like sometimes that perspective tends to settle in more as we get older. You know, when we're young, we think we could do anything, be anybody, go anywhere, do whatever we want. Nothing could stop me. Nothing can hold us back. And then cynicism starts to settle in over time. And we start to develop these principles. And God wants to come in and change that perspective. Change that perspective. What is our response? Romans 4, verse 17. As it is written, I have made you a father of many nations. He is our father in the sight of God in whom he believed. And then listen to this last part. The God who gives life to the dead and calls into being things that were not. God calls things into being as though they were not. God can change the facts. He can change the facts. He can change our principle. That's the God that we serve. So that was the first perspective, this principled perspective. The second one we see is the practical perspective. And we see this exhibited through Jesse, David's father. The practical perspective focuses on routine tasks and misses the bigger picture. As we continue on in this story, David is back home. His brothers are out on the battle lines. And Jesse, in verse 17, it says, and Jesse said unto David his son, take now for your brethren an ephah of parched corn and these 10 loaves and run to the camp to thy brethren. Verse 18, and carry these 10 cheeses unto the captain of their thousand and look how thy brethren fare and take their pledge. Jesse saw David as a delivery boy, as an errand boy. Go take this baguette, these nice organic cheeses from our farm, and bring them out to your brothers battling on the front lines. They are the warriors. They are fighting. David, go bring them some food. It was a very practical approach to a situation. Practicality is good. We need to be practical. That's okay. But if we are overly practical and overly only do things that are practical and safe and conservative and no risks involved in our own life, we will miss the things that God has for us. Think about some of the most biggest, difficult, life-changing decisions you've ever made in your life. Many times they probably weren't very practical. There's a time where we need to step out into faith. But Jesse was viewing David just through this practical lens, this practical perspective. And was forgetting and completely missing that the chapter just previously, this guy named Samuel, a prophet, came to Jesse's house and anointed David to be the next king of Israel. Yet the very next chapter, while all the brothers are at the front lines of the battle, David is at home watching the sheep and delivering cheese and bread to his brothers. David was quite a bit more than just an errand boy. He had a bigger call over his life. And David could have allowed that practical job that was given to him by his dad to affect who he was. He could have allowed it to get into his mind and maybe think to himself, you know what? Maybe I'm not fit out to be a king. Maybe I'm not fit out to be a warrior. Maybe Samuel the prophet had it wrong. Maybe all I'm good for is just to deliver bread and cheese. Maybe that is my role in this life. But God had a different plan for him. David could have let that define him. He could have let it hold him back from his full potential. Practicality is good, but it can limit us. See, in life, we're always faced with this balance between, as Christians, between faith and reason. And how do we reconcile the two? We are told to live by faith, to walk by faith. Yet we've also been given understanding and reason by the Lord, which is good, so that we don't do crazy, stupid things that we shouldn't do. So how do we reconcile the two of these? The response that we have is in Proverbs 3, verse 5. It says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and do not lean on your own understanding." It doesn't say ignore your own understanding, throw off all reason, and just be this, you know, fly by night, do whatever, take all the risks, and, you know, see what happens next. It just says don't lean on your own understanding. We have it as a safety mechanism, but it shouldn't define who we are. Sometimes we can get caught up in just doing what's practical, and days can go by, weeks can go by, months can go by, years can go by. And you look back 5 years, 10 years on your life, and it's just getting by, just the daily grind, practical, day in, day out. That's all it is, when God is calling us to live by faith. So we had the principled perspective of the Israelites, right? Then we have the practical perspective of Jesse, David's father, seeing him just as an errand boy. The third perspective we have is the projecting perspective. Projecting perspective. This one focuses inward emotions and faults onto others. Do you ever find that it's so easy to tell when somebody's projecting something on you, but so difficult to figure out when you're projecting something on somebody else? I mean, why is that, right? We're so good at recognizing it when it's happening to us, but when we're doing it to somebody else, we don't even realize it. We think we're speaking the truth in love or whatever it is. Projecting a perspective. This comes from David's oldest brother, Eliab. David was coming to deliver bread and some fine cheeses to his brothers. And when he got there, Eliab, his older brother, just saw the absolute worst in David. So what happens? Here David is. He is now sent to the battle lines. 40 days have been going on. And he shows up. And we pick up the story again in verse 25. And it said, David asked the men standing near him, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel?" So David shows up right about the same time Goliath is doing his regular daily routine of getting out there and ridiculing the Israelites. And David hears this and he's like, wow, this is interesting. And his response, I love this question. He says, "Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" Who is this guy? Who does this joker think he is? He's coming out here to defy the armies of the living God. And as he's asking this question, the Israelites, who are very principled focused, they immediately jump into the facts. Oh, well, that's Goliath of Gath, and he's from this hometown, and this is his family, and his armor weighs 125 pounds, and the tip of his spear is 15 pounds, and he's got a helmet, and he's over 9 feet tall. And David's thinking to himself, I don't want the details. I'm saying, who does this guy think he is? It was a rhetorical question. You're not supposed to answer it that way. Who does this guy honestly think he is? Who is this clown that he should defy the armies of the living God? The Israelites didn't understand David's question clearly, because as you proceed on in verse 26, it said, now the Israelites had been saying, "Do you see how this man keeps coming out? He comes out to defy Israel. The king will give great wealth to the man who kills him. He will also give him his daughter in marriage and will exempt his family from taxes in Israel." See, it's in there. I told you. There really was a lifetime tax exemption in this deal. David doesn't care about those facts. He doesn't care about those details. He's focused on who does this Goliath guy think he is that he could come out and do that and speak those things against my God. This has been going on for 40 days. Who is this guy? And as we continue in the story in verse 28, when Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men, he burned with anger at him. Eliab was pretty upset by this. Who does David think he is coming here and saying all these things? And who is this? Who is David? He burned with anger at him. And then Eliab asks his youngest brother a question. He says, "Why have you come down here? And who did you leave those sheep with in the wilderness?" Who's watching the sheep at home? David, what are you doing here? And then before Eliab even gives him an opportunity to answer the question, Eliab answers it for him, right? You ever done this before to others? Ask them a question, then you answer it before they get a chance. Eliab says, I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came down only to watch the battle. He says, David, what are you doing here? I'll tell you what you're doing here. You came to watch the battle because you just want to see the fight and the blood and the guts and the gore. And, you know, that's the only reason why you're here. He didn't even give David a chance to respond. He just projected this perspective on him. Projecting. It's a psychological defense mechanism where we project undesirable feelings or emotions onto someone else. Eliab was the oldest brother. Maybe he's a little hurt that he was not anointed to be king. Maybe he's thinking, how is it that David was the one that was anointed? And he says, I know how conceited you are. Conceited? David was just there with some bread and cheese, right? But I like this part. When Eliab says, you only came down to watch the battle. Let's think about this. Who was watching the battle here? For 40 days, Eliab had been there on the front lines watching Goliath come out for 40 days. David had only been there just a couple minutes. Who was the one that was really watching the battle? Sometimes we can be so quick to judge. We can be so quick to project things on others. Maybe because it makes ourselves feel better about ourselves. I don't know why we do that. It's just kind of human nature. I think I've shared this before, but there's this psychological term that I learned in graduate school. It's always stuck with me, called the fundamental attribution error. The fundamental attribution error. And I'll give you the psychological mumbo jumbo, and then we'll see this in real life, right? It's a tendency to overvalue personality-based explanations for the observed behavior of others while undervaluing situational explanations for those behaviors. All right, what does that mean? Practically put, it looks like this. Alice observes Bob tripping over a rock. Alice concludes Bob is clumsy. But then what happens when Alice trips over the same rock? She says, well, that rock was poorly placed. It shouldn't have been there. Who put that rock there? Why is it in the way? Who put it in the middle of the path? Clearly, the reason that I tripped over the rock is because of some external force at work. But when somebody else trips over the rock, it's because of some internal personality issue or problem with them. Sound familiar? We do this all the time. This really starts to come out in marriage. Maybe you've noticed that, right? Maybe not. Maybe you don't want to admit it, right? When you do something stupid, there's a reason why you did it. And you could explain it for a variety of factors, and you have all sorts of excuses, and that's a reason why that happened. But when your spouse does something stupid, then, you know, those external forces don't apply. It must be something with the person that you married, right? It is so easy for us just to project things on others. And you know what? We can do this in reverse, too. When you see a neighbor driving a super fancy brand new car, you think to yourself, I bet you they went into huge debt to buy that thing, right? Or, you know, I bet you their family, you know, they just come from money. You know, it's whatever. What happens when you drive the fancy new car? Oh, well, you know, I put in all sorts of work, and I just, you know, put in extra hours, and I'm really smart and successful, and I deserve this, right? It's not hard for us to have a better inflated view of ourselves than it is to have a good, positive view for those that are around us. We think highly of ourselves. What does Matthew chapter 7 say about this? Matthew 7 says, "Do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way that you judge others, you will be judged with the measure you use, and it will be measured to you." And this is the same passage that goes on and says, you know, before you attempt to remove a little speck, a little piece of sawdust out of your neighbor's eye, take the entire stick, the branch that is sticking out of your own eye, right? Saying the reason you're seeing these little specks is because you have bad vision to begin with. I think sometimes we focus too much on the stick and the speck. We need to go back just to verse 1, first three words. Do not judge. Do not judge. If we could think so highly of ourselves, we could easily think highly of others too. When you catch yourself thinking that way, stop yourself immediately and speak life and blessing over others. Let's change that perspective. We need to change that perspective. So we looked at the principled perspective from the Israelites. We looked at the practical perspective of Eliab and seeing David as a delivery boy. Then we saw this projecting perspective from Eliab. The practical perspective was from Jesse. The projecting perspective was from Eliab. Now we're moving into the fourth one, which I'm calling the political perspective. The political perspective. Who had this? This was Saul. And this perspective places personal interests over those of others. Saul was the king at the time, and he had a little bit of a PR crisis on his hands. He needed some damage control. He needed some messaging. He needed his best spin doctors to come on in and figure out, how can we manipulate or orchestrate this situation so that in the end, Saul comes out looking like a good king, right? He was already on thin ice, and he needed to boost. His approval ratings weren't doing so well. 40 days, Goliath had been coming out. He needed to change this. And this political perspective, I'm using this in the negative sense. Certainly, you know, in the political area, there's a perspective that's entirely focused on others and serving the community. But in this case, we're using it in the terms of Saul being concerned about himself and his own interests. And David's making all of this commotion. He's on the front lines. He's asking, who is this guy? Saul's hearing all of this going on, and he summons for David. And in verse 33, the story picks up again, and it says, "And Saul said to David, 'You are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, and he a man of war from his youth.'" Saul's thinking, this is not going to look good for me. If I send David out there, he's going to get pulverized. It's going to look like I, as king, sent out a little boy as a sacrifice to this guy Goliath. People are going to, you know, what are the headlines going to say if I allow this to happen? I don't know what's going through Saul's mind, but he's certainly kind of looking out for himself here. And what was David's response as this political perspective attempted to be put on him? It says, "But David said to Saul, 'Your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. And when a lion or a bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock,'" verse 35, David says, "'I went after it, struck it, rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by the hair, struck it, and killed it.'" David's a shepherd here. A lion comes after, takes one of his sheep away, and runs off. Now, I don't know about you, but for me, I'm like, you know what? It's just one sheep. Let it go. I've got more. I've got a whole flock. It's not worth it. I didn't really like that one sheep anyways. That's okay. The lamb looked hungry. It's circle of life. Let's move on, right? What did it say David did? The lion or the bear didn't attack him. It just took his sheep and ran. Verse 35, David says, "I went after it." Who does that? Who is this guy? I went after it. He chased down a lion running away with the sheep, and then the lion turned on him, so he struck it and killed it. And the same thing happened with a bear. So he's giving his credentials to Saul, and I love Saul's response after hearing this. Saul simply says to David, "Go and the Lord be with you." Like, all right, if you want to go, you go. But at least Saul could now claim that, you know, he checked David's resume, he did a psychological evaluation, he made sure that, you know, he was, you know, somewhat skilled in hand-to-hand combat. He wasn't purely just sending out a boy. But then what did Saul continue to do? In verse 38, it says that Saul dressed David in his own tunic. Oh, isn't that opportunistic? Hey, why don't you wear my clothes? I'll give you my armor when you go out and fight Goliath. In fact, here's a sword that you can use when you kill Goliath. This is going to look pretty good for Saul if by some chance David is victorious, right? Then Saul can say, yep, I handpicked him. David, our warrior, I sent him into battle. And yeah, the sword that killed Goliath was the king's sword. I don't know what Saul is thinking in this situation, but we can see how a lot of times we will allow a political perspective to benefit ourselves. And we can get caught in that mindset where we're looking out for ourselves first and everybody else next. It says in verse 39, David fastened on his sword over the tunic and tried walking around because he was not used to them. I cannot go in these, he said to Saul, because I am not used to them. So he took them off. As Saul is trying to dress him up, as Saul is trying to tell him who to be, how to fight, how to go out to battle, this is who you are, this is how you're going to do it, David recognized that, wait a minute, this is not who he was. He was a shepherd. This was not who he was. The world was trying to put this view, this perspective on him. You know, if David had given it a couple weeks, he probably could have gotten used to the armor. He probably could have, you know, gotten used to the sword. Sometimes we do that. These perspectives get put on us, and we know that's not really who we are, but instead of shaking it off, we kind of say, well, let me try to get used to it. Maybe that negative thing the person said about me, it doesn't feel right, but, you know, maybe that is who I am. Maybe I am just unsuccessful in this area of my life. Maybe this is always just going to be a struggle for me. And we start to believe these perspectives that are put on us. But what did David do? Immediately he realized, you know what, I'm not used to this. This is not who I am. I am taking this off. And he took it off. Influences, relationships. What is our response when this happens, when things are attempted to be put on us and placed on us by others that we know is not who we are in the core? Our response is Romans 12:2. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God and what is good and acceptable and perfect. Do not be conformed. David was not going to allow this, even coming from the king. And that's pretty tough to say no to the king. Remember, David's probably trying to get in good with the king. He knows that someday he's going to take his place. Is that really the right path to the kingdom, is by rejecting what he's trying to give to you? But David said, that's not who I am. I'm not going to compromise who I am. So then we get into the fifth perspective. Now we're starting to get closer to the battle. We're gonna look at Goliath and we're going to look at David. The fifth perspective is what I'm calling the pitiful perspective. And we see this in Goliath. The pitiful perspective produces feelings of sorrow and disappointment. This was Goliath's view. Verse 41. Meanwhile, the Philistine, with his shield bearer in front of him, kept coming closer to David. He looked David over. He looked him up and down. He sized him up and saw that he was little more than a boy, glowing with health and handsome, and he despised him. He was little more than a boy. Surprisingly, this is probably one of the better perspectives that individuals had of David. I mean, let's go back a little bit. Jesse pegged him as an errand boy, go and deliver some bread and cheese. Eliab perceived him as some conceited boy who only came to see the battle. Saul saw him as but a youth, but Goliath saw him as just a little more than a boy, just a little bit more, but he despised him. He was personally offended by it. He thought, this is pitiful. This is pathetic. I've been coming out for 40 days asking for the best of the best, and this is all you can produce, is this person who's just a little more than a boy? He thought it was pathetic. He thought it was pitiful. Doesn't this person know who I am? I'm Goliath. I'm this giant. And you're sending this little boy out to fight me? It's pitiful. How many times do we allow pity to creep into our perspective? Sorrow, disappointment, self-pity. Once we get into that pit, it's so hard to climb out of. Feeling sorry for ourselves, having despair, feeling disappointed. Goliath was disappointed. It's like, this is it? This is all you have? When we get stuck in that funk of self-pity, sometimes we keep looking inward and then we don't like what we see. So then we try looking outward and we don't like what we see over there either. And we just kind of go farther and farther and farther into this pit. We constantly go back and forth between the two. But you're not going to break self-pity by looking inward or by looking outward. You're only going to fix it by looking upward. By looking upward. To trust in the Lord. Psalm 37 verse 3 and 4 says, "Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and enjoy safe pasture. Delight yourself in the Lord and He will give you the desires of your heart." Maybe this is a perspective you're dealing with today, where just a sense of self-pity or sorrow or despair. Look upward. Look upward today. So are you getting ready for the sixth perspective? The good one? The one we should all have? Let's quickly recap. The Israelites tried to fill David in on all the facts and the principles of why they held back for 40 days. Jesse attempted to put David on the practical path. Just go deliver this bread and this cheese. Eliab projected this view onto David that he was just some conceited boy that arrived at the battle. Saul had this political perspective where he was looking out for himself first and everybody else second. And Goliath just pitied him and thought that it was a pathetic excuse for a warrior. But then we get to David. And David shows us the prophetic perspective. The prophetic perspective. This prophetic perspective can speak of the hopes, the dreams, the visions, the promises that we have in our life. And how we see things, how we view things. But most importantly, it focuses on the promiser over the promises. Remember back to chapter 16 when the prophet Samuel anointed David king. David didn't just sit back and wait for that crown to come. Just because the promise had been spoken, just because he had this dream, this vision that one day he would be the king over Israel, there were still things that he had to do to see it come to pass. There were still things that stood in his way. And the same is true for the promises in our own life. We can sit back and wait for things to happen. But I'm telling you, if you're going to do that, you may as well get a comfortable chair because you're probably going to be sitting for a while. If you just sit back and wait for it to happen, it's probably never going to happen. Or you can go out and grab it. What did David do? When the lion came, when the bear came, he went after it. He went after it. So whatever your hope is, your vision, your dreams, the things that God has spoken over your life, the things that you have set your attention and your eyes and your focus towards, don't wait any longer. Be like David. Go out and grab it today. David went after the lion. He went after the bear. He was sent to deliver cheese to the battle. But you know what? He brought his sling with him anyways. Nowhere in the story does it say he had to go back home to retrieve his sling before he went out to take on Goliath. He already had it with him. He was prepared for the battle. He knew that he was called to be king, but there were a few problems that stood in his way. Saul was on the throne. The Israelites were at war with the Philistines. Some joker named Goliath keeps coming out to the field and ridiculing the Israelites. But David knew that slaying the giant meant that he was going to have the hand of the princess in marriage. It meant that he was never going to have to pay taxes for him or his entire family again. Even that is symbolic. Think about it. Saul would no longer have this hold over David of, you have to pay tribute to me. He was even being set free from that. All of this, Goliath was the one thing that was standing in his way to continue on his path to the throne. But in this prophetic perspective, there's a danger for us. And that's we can get so caught up on the promise and we miss who the promiser is. I'm going to say it again. We can get so caught up on the promise, what we want to see come to pass, and we forget who the promiser is, who made that promise, who is God in the midst of the situation. Killing Goliath certainly opens up a path to the throne that may have appeared impossible otherwise. But personally, I don't think that was David's motivation. I think he was more concerned about what was being said about his God on the throne in heaven than creating a path to the throne here on earth. David was more concerned about what Goliath was saying about his God in heaven than how David could get to the throne here on earth. It was all about the promisor for him. So what happens? Verse 40 says, "Then David took his staff in his hand, chose five smooth stones from the stream, put them in the pouch of a shepherd's bag, and with his sling in hand, approached the Philistines." He went with just a stick, a sling, and five smooth stones. All of this stuff that had been projected on him, all these perspectives that had been put on him, it wasn't sticking with David. He was going with what he knew, his sling and those five stones. There was still significant risk involved. Why did David choose five stones? We know in the story it only took one. One stone is all that he needed. But he chose five. That shows us that sometimes when we step out in incredible faith like that, it's not always guaranteed. There's always an element of risk that is still involved. He didn't want to be presumptuous, and he didn't have an absolute definite word from God that one stone, one shot wonder, that's all you need, and go out to the battle with just that. He grabbed a few extra. He had five with him. Maybe he calculated how many shots he thinks he'd be able to get off before Goliath was face to face with him. I don't know what it was, but what the five stones show me is that there was still an element of risk involved in this. And such is the case when we step out in extreme faith. When Jonathan and his armor bearer went out against the Philistine garrison, what does it say? It says, maybe God will deliver us. I don't know for sure. Maybe God will deliver us. When the three Hebrew children were about to be cast into the fire for not bowing to Nebuchadnezzar and the statue, what did they say? They said, surely God will deliver us. But know this, king, even if he doesn't, we still wouldn't have bowed. We still wouldn't have done it. See, anytime we step out in extreme faith, there's still an element of risk there. And that's just something we have to face. If you are waiting for the absolute, you can't lose, it's definite, it's going to happen, guaranteed, what faith does that take, right? There's always that element of risk that is hanging out there. So David went to the battle. As we wrap things up here in verse 43, we see Goliath's response and then David's prophetic words against Goliath. Verse 43, Goliath said to David, "Am I a dog that you come at me with sticks?" Here's David. He's got his stick. He's got his staff. He's got his sling. And Goliath says, "Am I a dog?" Yeah, you are, Goliath. You are. You're the underdog in this story. If you didn't realize it yet, you're the underdog. And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. "Come here," he said. "I'll give your flesh to the birds and the wild animals." The trash talk starts to begin. David was much better at it, though. Because you go to verse 5, it says, "And David said to the Philistine, 'You come against me with sword and spear and javelin, I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day, the Lord will deliver you into my hands. I will strike you down. I will cut off your head. This very day, I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know that there is God, there is a God in Israel." Things just escalated here. It just got serious. Now think about this. David doesn't have a sword. He has a stick and he has five stones. How is he going to cut off Goliath's head? Well, very easy. He's going to strike him down, take Goliath's own sword and use that as a weapon against him. David is choreographing how this is all going to play out. I mean, this is like your ultimate James Bond villain. Like right before they try to kill James Bond, they reveal the entire plot. David is putting it out there. He's saying, "God, I'm telling you exactly how I'm going to do it. Here is my plan. This is exactly how it's going to go down." That was this prophetic perspective. And then we go to verse 47 as we wrap up this story and we wrap up this message. Says, "All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or by spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's." David didn't want the credit. It's not about David. It's not about his ascension to the throne. It's not about him as an amazing warrior. All the glory was going to God. David was more concerned about the promiser, about God, about the evils that were being spoken against his God in front of all these people by Goliath. He says, "For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands." As the Philistine moved closer, I love this part, as Goliath just starts to inch a little bit closer, move just a little bit closer, what does it say? David ran. David, not away, he ran quickly toward the battle line to meet him. He ran to it. The same way he went after that lion and the bear who took his sheep, the same way he went after it again. And we need that sort of go after mentality where when troubles and tribulations come against us, we're not running from them. We're not kind of doing the hokey pokey and putting the right foot in and the right foot out. We are running towards the battle because of who God is in our life. That is this prophetic perspective that trumps all of the others. Amen? Yes. Amen. Stand up with me. Just go ahead and bow your heads with me as we pray, as we wrap this up. We need that prophetic perspective. That lens shift, that perspective change. I don't know which of these perspectives spoke to you. Maybe you're kind of caught up in principles. Well, you know what? God changes facts. He rewrites principles. Maybe you're just kind of caught up in the day-to-day practical, day in, day out. You know, what makes sense today? Let's just live by reason. And God say, no, it's time to start living by faith. Lean not on your own understanding. Maybe you found yourself projecting towards others, thinking poorly about others, thinking poorly about yourself, projecting onto your own self, judging others. Judge not. See the best in others. See the best in yourself. Maybe that sort of political perspective, you know, looking out for yourself. How can I get out of this situation? How can I orchestrate things for my own benefit? Or maybe that's being put on you by somebody else, influences in your life, or trying to tell you to be somebody that you're not. Don't be conformed to this world. Or you're caught up in that pitiful perspective and sorrow and despair. Don't look inward. Don't look outward. Look upward. Whatever it is, we need David's perspective, this prophetic perspective that focuses on who God is in our situations. Father, seal this word in our hearts today. Give us your perspective in everything we walk through. And change our hearts, change our minds to see things the way that you see things. In your name we pray. Amen. Amen. Let's worship.